there's a lot of neutral Northerners who suddenly went, whoa, that is a violation of my civil liberties if I've ever seen one.
Right.
And it did this beautiful thing where it connected the complete trouncing of freedoms and rights that afflicted enslaved individuals at this time and married them to the suppression of civil rights of white Northerners. That would remain married together until the end of the Civil War. This idea that, oh, our rights are not being taken away.
Welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, the podcast that digs deep into the juicy stories, power plays, and wild twists that shaped the presidencies of the United States. I am Kyle, the navigator who's supposed to keep our Captain Eric Mason on course. And if you ask our editor, I'm probably the worst offender.
You're good, brother.
Past episode had like 30 minutes cut out of it. That's how much asides we had.
We had so much fun.
Oh,
that last episode, that was for us. That was us time.
That and there's probably going to be about 30 minutes worth of short contents made for that.
Oh, I'm trying to think of all the rants I went on.
I don't think there's anything. Don't worry. You know, I take care of
you. God, thanks, scare me.
All right. Where were we at? Last episode? Yeah, we set the stage for the beginning of the reign of the Jacksonian Party. Because we're just getting to Old Hickory's election. And I learned something in between last recording and this one. Oh, actually, scary. Laura figured it out. She told me. Did you know how the donkey became associated with the Democratic Party?
I would just assume it was because Jackson was super stubborn and donkeys are stubborn.
That is what. That's what exactly what it said. It said it was that and the name Jackson sounded a lot like jackass. So his opponents were calling him a jackass.
It is a fire symbol, just for the record. I think both political parties are pretty fire. Elephant and a donkey are pretty solid symbols.
What I thought was fascinating, so I did a little bit more of a deep dive into this, but Jackson embraced it. So his enemies were like calling him that, right? They're making fun of him. He embraces it, and then like, you know, the sturdy donkey, the noble donkey, you know, he's all about it. It goes away once he leaves office, and then in 1870, it comes back again from a political cartoonist. He was using it to make fun of the Northern Democrats who opposed the war, the Civil War.
Oh, that is a rare group of people to target. I like that.
Right? But then somehow from that it came. Somehow from that it came out to be the thing. Like then it became like the symbol, the unofficial symbol. I guess they never really adopted it.
I think, you know, this has been a moment I've been both happy and dreading. I have to honestly say this is probably outside of the John Quincy Adams. The fourth episode of John Quincy Adams. This is the most time I think I've spent, not just on the research side, but on the review. Because, Kyle, you know this better than me. Like, I have a hard time with Jackson. I have a very hard time with him as a person. Don't think he held up well. I think right now, I mean, I think he caused the worst financial recession in U.S. history, depending on who you ask. I think he caused the Civil War. I think he did all these horrible things. But we need to be objective. And I feel like this is fairly objective. It's not going to be, is it?
Nah, probably not. I mean, it's about as objective a thing as you can get. Which, to be honest, I mean, like, look, I was not expecting the first two episodes to make me like the guy. Like, I've been rooting for him. Like, I want him to be better, but he's not.
Yeah, I think I might have, like, overcorrected in the first two episodes. Like, I was really trying to paint him as, like, knowing this episode's coming. Just to let you guys know, like, behind the scenes, I draft these episodes starting with their presidency. So your episode three, like, when you're listening to Kyle and I go through episode three, that's episode one in my notes. Like, right now, I'm at the top of my note sheet because I'm trying to figure out how to, not explain, but a lot of times I'm trying to look at major presidential events and be like, well, how does that make him more human? Because I think that's kind of the only way to do it because these are real people. Sometimes I think that gets missed in the history books. These are people making decisions. In Jackson's case, he's making really, really bad decisions that do not hold up well over time or even after time. It's important to remember that John Quincy Adams is during a lot of this portion in Congress being like, hey guys, we need to fix the slavery issue.
Right.
So Kyle, do you want to jump in so I can continue to have a moral crisis on me trying to present Jackson as a neutral human being?
I mean, why don't we just start with the election. We covered some of the election, the previous election that he lost to Mr. J.Q. Wade. Then he comes about, and this is the second one now, right?
Yeah, and it's not that You know, it's really not that interesting of an election. And I hate to say that, but John Quincy Adams.
There's no corrupt bargain in this one?
No. John Quincy Adams doesn't really run. At this point, the Jacksonian party is in full fury. They've been campaigning for almost 3.5 years. Don't forget his home state of Kentucky already. Did I say Kentucky? His home state of Tennessee.
There you go.
Already elected him. As their nomination. It was kind of preordained, but the momentum was already there. Yeah. You have a president running who didn't really have a political party. You know, was John Quincy Adams a Democratic Republican? Was he a National Republican? Whigs hadn't really arrived on scene. The people who would form the Whig Party were already active. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
The term Whig comes from after a series of rulings, to be honest with you, or a series of rules put out by Jackson. People started calling him King Andrew, and Whigs, the Whigs in the in England were the anti-royalists. So we didn't really have the name Whig yet because that hadn't really occurred. Yeah. By the way, that's a weird thing when you get taught history. Like, they'll be, the Whig Party forms in like the 1830s. And it's like, well, no, very specifically after a point in the 1830s. Like, nobody came up with this idea until afterwards.
Why did they call it? Why was it spelled weird too? Does Whig mean something different?
I'm wondering if it's like the British spelling of Whigs, like they're putting in the extra, putting in the extra letters and stuff, because it's W-H-I-G. You're right, not W-I-G.
I think we got some British listeners. Maybe they know. Comment.
Yell at me.
Yeah.
Eric, you're horrible. Dude, why does it feel like it'd be way funnier if it's spelled W-I-G? Yeah, so you end up with kind of a very predetermined election. John Quincy Adams didn't campaign. He thought it was below the president to campaign.
Campaign at all.
Pretty much not at all. He pretty much stayed in the White House. Oh. It is, again, I will bring this up. I think we had a short that did pretty well of me having what I would describe as a crash out on people thinking that Thomas Jefferson was a common man John Adams, who could make you a pair of shoes, versus a guy with soft hands and playing the violin every day. Somehow the guy who can make you a pair of shoes and runs a farm is less of a common man than the dude who owns a bunch of slaves and plays the violin. It's very, very confusing to me. This is the same thing. Like, John Quincy Adams was because they're too much of an aristocrat. And this is a dude who, like, eating like crackers and cheese and yogurt and swimming in the Potomac. It was, like, notorious for just being like that. Like, everybody probably has a coworker whose husband's just like, no, I'll show up at the bar. And he'll just sit there and drink a beer by himself. If you want to go talk to him, very pleasant guy to talk to. But if you don't, he'll just sit there for 3 hours and just enjoy life. That was like John Quincy Adams.
But that is kind of aristocratic, though. I mean, if you don't have to work or do anything for a living, and his family was the only one that actually like left any generational wealth behind, right?
Yes, that's true. And he did, but he did serve his country, and he did he served his country as a civil servant for many decades,
starting at 14.
Yeah, but Jack. Yeah, it was when he went over on his first diplomatic mission. Jackson, though, talk about not working. I mean, he bought a bunch of slaves and had them work the land. Like, so he literally was not specifically working. And he was like, I'm going to marry for money.
He did pull himself up by his bootstraps and marry into that wealth.
Yeah, by his bootstraps and married wealth. I don't know why I just gave Jackson like a wicked bad Boston accent. I'm going to marry for money. it was that common man. He was seen as a common man. Jacksonian democracy is really the first. I know we mentioned this in previous episodes. We started to see our first prominent, persistent, and upfront discussion of populism on the American political scene. Jackson was a populist. There's really no super easy way to get around it. But like we talked about earlier, populism looks different based on the political perspective that's advocated for populism.
That's basically who's voting.
Yeah.
Right?
In economics, we call it rent-seeking. It's the idea that you vote for people who will then give you things.
Yeah.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge in developed worlds. It's a almost impossible hurdle in developing worlds when it comes to trying to institutionalizing democracy. Rent-seeking can be very dangerous rent-seeking can be dangerous in general in a macroeconomic sense, but it can be particularly dangerous when you are a very labor-focused economy. Capital doesn't vote.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's a controversial. Is that kind of controversial, Kyle? I don't know.
Not really.
Yeah. I think it influences elections, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it like pays for lobbyists. And
right? Here is one bridge. March of 1829, Andrew Jackson gets elected. And this is really kind of our first big party we see for the inauguration, especially in D.C. Like, there was certainly a... Oh, you said so. You look excited, Kyle.
Yeah, I just remember where this what this is based on, I think.
Oh, now I feel like I have to live up to something.
Wasn't there a wild ass party they threw?
I think we talked about one of the previous like things learned episodes or whatever.
Yeah.
So 15,000 to 20,000 people, like ordinary Americans, attend the inauguration. This is huge. This is huge even for if you counted everybody in the previous, just ordinary Americans, dignitaries.
Now, when you say attended the inauguration, do you mean like they actually showed up to the White House, like inside the White House? Or just on grounds?
So the way the author, one of the authors I used for this, a couple of the authors I used for this, but specific to a lot of the the Jackson archives, that 15,000 to 20,000 number, based on the newspapers that came out of it. But by the way, there's a bunch of newspapers that have that number. Sometimes you see 12,000 to 18,000, 15,000 to 20,000. One newspaper is like 25,000. So I feel pretty safe saying 15,000 to 20,000 was probably a realistic number.
Seems reasonable. Yeah.
That is how many attended the inauguration. So you're thinking him getting sworn in.
Yeah.
How many made it back to the party at the White House? That's a little different. So it became incredibly rowdy. They had to, you know, it's not true, but there's an old, one of the newspapers wrote they had to throw whiskey out the windows to get people to leave.
I heard that. Yeah.
Yeah. We don't know how many went back to the White House. There are contemporary reports that estimate a number. They're all over the place, dude. It's not like the inauguration where it's like, oh, between 12,000 and 25,000, but with like all these different reports. But just think of it. The White House at this time isn't as large as it is. It was a large place. Don't get me wrong. But just tons of people in there. They have the super rowdy party. And this
kind of just get restored after being burned down too.
Yeah. Yeah. It got restored maybe like 6-7 years, I believe, before. Yeah, this, think of the guy who had to restore that. The poor guy had to repaint that. It was just like, oh, come on, man.
We just start over.
We just, like, I just painted it, jerks. But right off the bat, Jackson begins something called the spoil system, which is going to surprise a lot of people that this is what it's called, because it's kind of what happens today at the federal level.
Sounds like sounds like stealing and redistributing stuff that you've taken from other places.
Oh, don't worry. He did that with the French in his presidency, but this is more about who he puts into cabinet positions.
I see.
So he comes in there and he replaces all these entrenched office holders with his loyal supporters. And what he referred to as rotation in office. And so he takes all his allies to help him get elected. Remember, this was a 3-year campaign. He made a lot of allies and probably a lot of promises. That's speculatory. Everybody thought it was speculatory, that comment, over that time period. And so he rewards them. Specifically, the big one was Martin Van Buren was named Secretary of State. John Eaton was named Secretary of War. We'll come back to Mr. Eaton in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And he insists that this purge is needed to reform the corrupt bureaucracy and make government more responsive to the people.
This is 1830s.
This is 1830. Mid-ish 1829, and the press has a field day with this. Even though Jackson enjoys a lot of popular support, it's the press that names this the spoil system, and basically saying you're giving people who helped you get elected jobs in your administration. And now a lot of Americans would say, like, wait, is that how it works?
That's like kind of like status quo these days, isn't it?
So this is actually where that starts. Before, it was seen as kind of weird to appoint people who weren't absolute experts, and in fairness to Jackson, and I do want to say in fairness to Jackson, John C. Calhoun stayed on as vice president. So the same vice president, John Quincy Adams, was under him.
Yeah.
So at this point, John C. Calhoun has been, in and around the vice presidency for, a long time. And they will have a falling out later, John C. Calhoun and Andrew Jackson. It's not as part of the spoiled system. And John C. Calhoun resigns intentionally, involuntarily, to go become the senator of his home state. So, to be fair to Jackson, the spoiled system definitely occurred. I don't think there's any major historian that doesn't see this as the spoiled system. But it wasn't as wide. It was widespread, but it wasn't as holistic. I mean, when you're not even replacing your vice president, something has to be said for that. And I think in a fair suit to Jackson, that should be acknowledged.
He didn't wipe out the entire cabinet. He didn't wipe out the entire bureaucracy. He didn't clear out the Fed. Oh, we don't have a Fed at this point.
Oh, he tried. Oh, the central. He did have he danced around with the Treasury, Mr. Secretary Duane. well, we'll get to
All right.
So he enters office, and he's this common man that everybody keeps calling him, which, again, I don't know how you get that image.
Like, well, he started out as slaves. I guess when you start out as an orphan, like, that's – once you're a common man, I guess you're always a common man. I think that's the way it works with prestige in this country.
Yeah, that's a good point. All right, so what did Jackson set out to do as the common man, right? He believed in a very frugal government. That's a word that if you read a lot about Jackson, I'm sure Jackson's really popular. So I'm kind of excited to see kind of, you know, some of the emails and stuff we get. Hopefully just yelling at me for my takes on Jackson, which is fair. It's absolutely fair to yell at me. Don't yell at Kyle. Kyle's a good man trying to control a wildfire, right, and he should not be yelled at.
No, you can yell at me. It's fine.
But so what were like his policies? And you know, Kyle, this is kind of funny. When I first started this research, I was like, I know broadly at the 30,000 foot level what Jackson's policy was. But I sat down and I was like, I don't know if I could tell you in deep, deep detail his specific platform. I know what he did. Like, I have the retrospective history view of it. But I was like, I bet it'd be cool to figure out, like, what was he campaigning on?
Yeah.
Like, his campaign just can't be, I don't like John Quincy Adams. Actually, if you look historically throughout the history of the United States, you very rarely win by just not liking the other person.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's like,
it feels like all politics is.
Oh, you could just not like the other person, but very rarely set a platform to get people to go and vote for you.
Gotcha.
his whole thing was he just wanted to get rid of the federal debt. He wanted to eliminate the national debt. He didn't want federal involvement in projects. He didn't want, you know, obviously, a lot of that due to the Native American tribes. I think he has a very, again, I'm trying to be objective, but a very bad history with Native American tribes, especially ones in Spanish held territories.
So this is actually very interesting that you bring that up again, because I was curious, growing up in Appalachia where he did, and Waxaw, I think is what we...
Waxaw! Yeah.
Like, he had a lot of interactions with, like, the Cherokees and other Native American tribes out there. You'd think he would have had a much better relationship with them. Yeah. Or is it just he liked them and didn't like the other ones?
Oh, this gets really dark. And Kyle, talk about a beautiful segue. Guys, I swear Kyle does not get to see these notes at a time. Kyle, my next sentence was going to be, he basically gets into office. He had talked about dealing with the indigenous nations problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know what term you use. You read different, like, historians, I'll use a different term, but, like, it depends when they were written. But I'm going to use the term indigenous nation. Like, that was kind of the broad stroke that he has. But he had this idea of there was this indigenous nation problem. When I first read that, I was like, oh, yeah, it's just because he did, like, Native Americans and he's blah, blah, blah. You know, I kind of got, like, the pop history view. But I was like, do what? I want to give him a fair shake. Let me dive a little bit into this. So he viewed removing... I'm going to quote it directly from the notes just because I wrote it down. But basically, he viewed this as a necessity, the movement of indigenous nations, necessary to advance white settlement. And this is where it gets interesting, paternalistically, to shield native people from extinction. He believed that as white settlement would advance into Native American held territory, into indigenous people, indigenous nations and their people's land, that it would inevitably lead to conflict, that inevitably... would lead to the eradication of Native people in that area. So he viewed moving them, and over the course of his presidency, as we talk about it, trying to move them into the indigenous lands in Missouri and further out west.
He's not wrong, but he's also the ones who they send to eradicate them when they have problems with the settlers. So, like, he's also the problem. If you just stopped eradicating them, then maybe you could work something else out.
And, well, I think we have a better understanding of Jackson's view on slavery. I think in a similar sense that applies to Native people, where with Native people, he viewed this as this persistent conflict, that conflict was a natural state. Yeah. That's how he viewed slavery. That's what makes his stance on slavery. We talked in previous episodes very strange compared to Jefferson, Monroe, or I should say Jefferson and Madison, and especially Monroe, that he viewed this as a natural order. I think he viewed that with indigenous nations, that the natural order is you're going to have these white settlements advance, and that is the natural order, and these groups will become extinct because that's the natural order.
It's wild to me how often the justification seems to be that they're trying to protect the people they're murdering.
I mean, that's paternalism. That's why there's so much problems with paternalism. That's what makes that's what makes James Monroe one of my favorite episodes we've done so far. Right. Because James Monroe has that weird view where he's like, he viewed them because he grew up as like middle class guy whose family had a couple slaves. That's why he was such a supporter of the American colonial society, because he was like, oh, he viewed them as intellectually equal to him. But he just was like, oh my God, this culture is never going to be able to collide with ours, because like, how do you take a bunch of people who used to be slaves and then set them free within a nation? Like, that's going to only lead to bad things. And so he's like, oh, well, you know, we'll build a country somewhere else and let them go to it. And I'm not saying that's right. Right? That didn't work either. I'm not saying that's right. But at least on the Monroe side, you could see him trying to like, oh my God, how do I suss this out? Jackson didn't have any of that. Jackson was just straight paternalistic. On the Native American things, I would not describe Jackson as paternalistic on slavery. He was just, all slavery is crude. He was even worse. He was like really bad to like just downright, you know, just, I'm going to say disrespectful is too light of a word, but downright.
Almost took joy in it, I think is what you, how you describe
it. To him,
it
was a status symbol. I own somebody else, which is like weird. It's one thing to say the society aspect of it, that's really messed up. But to be like, I'm a poor orphan, I want to make other people poor so I can be wealthier. It's like, oh, that's a little bit of a psychopath move. that's going to be a short, isn't it?
That is going to be a fire short.
but with Native Americans, and it's important to remember that Andrew Jackson had an adopted Native American son that he raised. People, some historians.
Did we talk about that? Because I don't remember hearing that.
We talked about it a little bit last episode, in, you know, he. It depends who you read. Some people, some revisionists, pro-Jacksonian revisionists, will be like, oh, he hand-raised him and all that. It's like, okay, that was rare. And like, John Adams is considered like an overly involved father compared to like everybody else. he was living on another continent. he was raised in the household, but I mean, I still don't want to take it away from Jackson. Like, he found a Native American child and like raised him, paid for his schooling and all that stuff. So like, very interesting relationship. So, but it was this heavily paternalistic view that he was like, we're going to resettle indigenous nations because white settlements as they advance will eradicate them, which is like, how about, I don't know, you just respect their right to exist. That's also just, you could just go non-genocide.
We just go
That's
around. We can go around like this other land.
Negotiate, trade. We're usually all better off if we're trading. That's kind of like the one thing you learn about economics. The one thing in economics, like everybody agrees on, is like, if you trade, you have better outcomes. It's like, what about everything else is controversial except that one line? So like, I don't know, just not erratic.
Try that.
That was part of his policy. It was, you know, dealing with the Indian lands question, limiting government, and getting rid of debt. Which is...
That's a pretty solid platform.
Pretty solid platform, especially with 1829. Now, the Indian question was always... And by the way, I'm going to use the term Indian now because it was literally called the Indian question. I'm colloquially using it in the 1820s, 1830s term. Nobody knew how to answer it. It was like the slave question. Except instead of the slave question, they had this kind of static quo with the occasional uprising. There was just straight up open warfare going on. And we'll talk about the Second Seminole War. Second Seminole War is one of the most interesting military actions ever in the history of the United States, and it doesn't get taught at all. Part of the reason I understand why it doesn't get taught, this, what we're talking about right now, first gets taught in about seventh grade history, and usually doesn't get taught again until maybe your junior year, and it's taught by really fast, because the period between the Founding Fathers and the period between the Civil War is kind of no man's land. That pre-antebellum period is like just not talked about that much. That's a platform most people can understand. Let's not have debt. And he championed.
If you're just looking at it and not digging into what the plan is, like not knowing what his plan is for solving the question that he's asking, I can get behind it. Like, this looks like a pretty good platform.
Yeah. And he phrased his removal of the national debt as a gift to future generations. This all goes awry immediately. Like, he had a lot of, at that time, policy successes that just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And what's going to happen, we're going to talk a little bit about the legacy of Jackson in our fourth episode, and that's going to primarily focus around the removal, how the process of removing Native individuals from their lands. So we're going to talk about Worcester versus Georgia, and we're also going to talk about the Panic of 1837, which was caused by Andrew Jackson. You're going to read that historians, you're going to read historians who aren't sure. I'm going to go out, I'm going to play the little, like, the economist card here for a second and say, it was definitely caused by him. Why was it not caused by him? What are we talking about? They're like, oh, there was a giant credit crunch and land speculation went awry because we lost liquidity. And it's like, the guy who got rid of the national bank and then required hard currency for the purchase of items
caused a credit crunch.
Yeah, I'm like, what do you mean? This is pretty straightforward. I understand most, like, who caused the Great Recession? Complicated answer. Who caused the Great Depression? Complicated answer. When did America come out of, like, the Great Depression? This is not a complicated answer. Some guy was like, hey, you can't use money for the thing you're buying anymore. And they're like, oh, so I need to go get a bunch of gold for these things? Yes. But they only want to give me hard currency. They only want to give me currency because that's easier to exchange. Yeah, I don't care. And then there's a recession. He's like, who could have done this? What could have caused it? I keep talking about, dude. Even if you're like, oh, it wasn't his presidency. It was the tariffs of abomination. Hold on. Let me take out my book and see. Okay. Who advocated for the tariffs of abomination to make John Quincy Adams look bad? The Jacksonian. Okay. So it's him also. What are we talking about? He caused it. What is this?
If we remember the tariffs of abomination, he voted them in because he had no choice. It was either the extreme version or nothing, right?
Yeah. And it was led by Martin Van Buren. Which I have written here is, quote, Andrew Jackson's patsy. And that's a fact. Argue with me. Martin Van Buren was not a person. He was a puppet that was orchestrated by Andrew Jackson. I just refuse to believe that. Just everything I read about Martin Van Buren is like, he's just Andrew Jackson, but like not as charismatic and kind of less tough.
All right. So it looks like he's going to win this election on a pretty strong campaign, sounds like. Sounds like once the policies start going into place, that's when it starts going downhill.
Oh, immediately. In your mind. Yeah. 1830s, it starts going downhill.
I think you mentioned you had a list of policies. You want to just start working your way through this list, maybe? And maybe that'll be a little less objective if you're just reading headlines.
Yeah, I feel like when I'm going off my notes, I'm very objective. I feel like when I go off the notes, it's not objective at all. So I need to stick to the notes. Sorry, Kyle. You deserve better than this.
That's a pretty good rant you went on, though. God,
I'm so angry. Who caused this? That guy! That guy right over there! What are you talking about? And I do love historians who are like, they're trying to be measured, but I'll tell you, economists were not. We're like, no, it's that dude. Take out a $20 bill, stare at it. It's that guy.
Yeah.
All right, so... Okay, let's start with his first act he really starts pushing through. All right, okay. And that's the it's called the Indian Removal Act, specifically the Indian Removal Act.
That's the first thing he did.
Yeah, that was like the first thing he did. Yeah.
Okay.
He like gives a message to Congress, his State of the Union. He gave in like December of 1829, and he outlined his entire policy positions, which is federal funds should only go to national improvements, not individual states. We need to do a rotation in office to prevent corruption, i.e. put my friends into office.
to prevent corruption.
Yeah, right. And then get rid of the debt. So, normally you think you'd lead off with, oh, let's get rid of the debt. But he's like, no, let's get rid of the Indians first. I was like, oh, okay. Wild move first, but all right.
Gift to future generations.
Yeah, right. So you have the Indian Removal Act of 1830. And Congress passes it. He has control over Congress at this time, and he signs it, and it authorizes the president to negotiate I want to phrase this right because it gets a little weird how it's worded. He has the right to negotiate the exchange of Native American lands in the southeast for new lands west of the Mississippi. That's also west of the Mississippi. So he gets up there, and it was very specific that he had to negotiate. You couldn't just kick them off their land. You had to negotiate as fairly as you can say 1830s Congress. Land east west of the Mississippi, which means nothing, by the way. That's like trying to negotiate. Like, I'm from Massachusetts. Like, you can leave Massachusetts, but you have to go to New Mexico for equal part. I'm like, no, but I mean, yeah, you give me land equal to what I have in Massachusetts, but like, yeah, want to be Massachusetts.
It's not quite the same. Landscape's different, the country's different, the roads are different, the rivers, the mountains, everything.
I was going to say the soil. Strong institutional framework that makes up the Massachusetts economy, but also, I guess I can say grass.
Also, somebody else probably lives in that land they're giving you too, right?
It's like if another guy from Massachusetts already owns that land, and it's like, Massachusetts actually is a state named after a Native American tribe.
There's a bunch of them.
Is it Arkansas also?
I think so. Illinois, I think, was one, too. Yeah.
New York. Trying to think of the West Virginia tribe. So he gets this authority, and he immediately starts trying to negotiate with different Native American tribes. And the way he viewed it is that this was both essential for U.S. expansion and for the survival of Native tribes who were under the pressure from white settlers, kind of what I spoke about a little earlier. Yeah. And under this Axe power, he immediately meets with the Choctaw. I want to make sure. Choctaw.
They're in Oklahoma now, I think, right?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
The Chickasaw, the Creek, the Cherokee, and the Seminoles. By the way, anybody, like, I apologize. I can barely pronounce my name. So
yes.
And so he presses them. They end up giving up their ancestral lands. And some nations do comply. It's all under duress. And the act leads to dozens of these scatterplot removal treaties. And then eventually just you end up with the forcible uprooting of, you know, tens of thousands of these indigenous folks. And, you know, this actually really all happens in a few years, 1838 to 1835. The story, you know, sometimes the story of the American and Native American, that gets discussed as America's longest war. And I think there's totally an argument for that. And it's this discussion of this huge time period, right? Like the 1830s, 1820s to the 1890s, 1880s, depending on who you ask. I think sometimes we think it's a homogenous event the same thing going, and it's not. And this is one of the most traumatic actions in that time period, because over those 3 years, 1835 to 1838, the Cherokee, you know, very famously in the during the Trail of Tears, infamously during the Trail of Tears, was a direct outcome of Jackson's policies here.
Yeah.
And there was no equitable exchange. Do I think Jackson believed he was being equitable? I actually do think he believed he was being equitable. Any outside observer, even at that time period, because we had a Supreme Court case. We had Worcester versus Georgia. We had two Supreme Courts. We had the Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, and then we had Worcester versus Georgia suing for this. And
remember, too, what you say about these are people, right? Like, think about his history, the life that he lived. What does he think is going to be fair and equitable? The fact that you're even giving him something for the land that you're taking, like, to him is probably above and beyond what he felt he probably had caused or need to do.
Yeah. Dude, 100%. You know, and I think that's what's important as we go through this, is to remember that, looking at through Jackson's eyes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and we're going to circle back around as we get later into his presidency, talking about what Jackson did and his view on Native Americans. But it's important that I want to bring up front that contextualization, because this happened within his first year of his presidency, him doing this. And I think it's telling that the first thing he did was this.
Right. Yeah. So what's the second thing he did?
Incredibly controversial. Somehow.
Really?
More controversial than moving. Probably tells you what the average person at the time thought about Native American land rights, because this was considered less controversial than what I'm about to tell you, which is the Maysville Road veto, which occurred in May. It occurred on May 27th, 1830. This gets real petty, dude. We're gonna get immediately petty. So we remember our old friend Henry Clay, who Jackson said, you know, orchestrated the corrupt bargain with John Quincy Adams, despite Jackson's people approaching Henry Clay to do it. Let's just leave that as historical footnote.
Yeah, he refused our offer, so he must have taken a better one from this guy. Yeah.
Let's put him on the $20 bill and not put the guy who argued argued for the emancipation of all people.
Yep.
Maysville Road, it's this road in Kentucky. It's contained completely in Kentucky. And so Kentucky is looking for federal funds. In fact, it passes Congress. It gets all the way to his desk. And he vetoes it. Because he's like...
Oh, that's probably why the cartoon that I found that had him riding the jackass, like, that was the thing he was saying. Something about veto. I'll veto it.
Yeah.
So it must have been about this event.
Yeah, so he ends up vetoing it, and it's kind of his middle finger to Henry Clay, and he's like, hey, you know, you don't get your road, because it's a local project. It needs to be into other states. It needs to be across the entire country. And this is kind of our first departure from the American system we see. Remember, the American system is the idea of, like, we need to build up infrastructure all over the country.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he keeps championing Cumberland Road, which is this massive road that connects through a couple states in the Mid-Atlantic South area.
Well, if it connects a couple states, then that's cross state. That
yeah, so fits consistent.
With what he's saying.
Very, very, it's consistent. Very consistent. Yeah. But it's still seen as like
so far.
Yeah. And here's the funny thing. So Congress is considered power of the purse. So even to the day we use that term. Congress gets to spend money.
Yes.
And the executive branch follows it out. Well, a lot of people in Congress, and I actually agree with Jackson on this one, a lot of people in Congress were like, that's actually a violation of the principles of the Constitution because Congress voted to pay for this. You shouldn't be allowed to veto that. And he's like, it's a bill. Yeah, I vetoed it. If it passed, then I have to follow through. And if you override me, I still will execute it. But I'm allowed to veto bills. That's in the Constitution.
He's not wrong.
I don't think he's wrong. And this is where Jackson becomes complicated because throughout it, because I'm going to try and stay objective if I stay on script, you're going to be like, oh, I don't agree with that, but I see his perspective on it.
He is consistent with it, too. Like, he's been consistent. I don't agree with many of the things he says, but he at least did the things that he said he was going to do when he got elected, right?
Yeah. And, you know, we end up going into – so he ends up, you know, vetoing that bill. Cumberland Road gets its funding. And we start to see Andrew Jackson, the diplomat, emerged. And I got to say, Andrew Jackson – had a lot of diplomatic success in his administration.
Florida?
Oh, part of it's like with Florida, but Florida was already like part of the United States with the Adams-Onis Treaty.
After he went down there and like took it?
Just like overthrew governors. Yeah. Like, dude, that was not your job.
That's pretty good democracy, is what I'm saying.
It'd be like if a bouncer outside a club went into another club and beat up the bartender and took over the bar. It was like, hey, I stopped the other people. It's like, what are you doing? That was not part of your description. Put that guy back. But in a cool move. So Jackson, actually very quietly, this was not like big national news at the time. There was several trade disputes we had with Great Britain that were just it was like there was one massive dispute. It was everything from the Jay Treaty to the War of 1812 to the Treaty of Ghent, all that stuff. It wasn't cleaned up. So you had like some British colonies, especially British colonies in the West Indies, who like weren't accepting U.S. ships because they didn't know what they were doing here. and so because they were restricted, we restricted them in some of our ports. So it became this like mess. So basically, Andrew Jackson reached out to Britain and said, can we clean this up? Like, what's going on here? It was very brief negotiations. And by October of 1830, U.S. ships are being welcomed into British colonies again. Like, Jackson kind of just reached out and was like, guys, I know, do we not like each other? And the Brits are like, no, we're cool with you. What's up? And they were like, can we just, we have like 9 treaties concurrently. And like, what's going on? They're like, we'll clean all that up. And actually, with the passage of the previous tariffs, this actually spikes revenue into the treasury and helps actually end the national debt.
So is that why he felt confident enough, I guess, in disbanding the bank and getting rid of this credit? Because now we're flush with cash?
That's definitely part of it. There's actually this real controversy where we start having federal surpluses and we don't know what to do with them. So we end up like giving them to states, but that causes its own issues in of itself.
I don't think Jackson would like that.
No, Jackson did it. Jackson like tried to give money back to states. He was this kind of weird federalist, but not anti-federalist guy.
How do you decide who gets what cut of that? That's got to be.
They never actually figured it out.
Yeah.
Like they did it, but they never figured out anything that made sense. Like government, they never figured it out, but they did it.
That tracks.
So as you move, and you know, I would say his first year, you know, especially looking at where we are in this episode, his first year felt like a long time to get through. But in reality, everything kind of starts sprinting the rest of his presidency. So we go into 1831, and that's just absolutely mired in cabinet rotation. You have the Peggy Eaton affair, which is
Peggy. I don't remember that one.
Yeah, so Peggy Eaton. So you had Secretary of War John Eaton. It's his wife. This is sometimes called the Petticoat Affair.
I think I've heard that name before.
Yeah, where one of the best names ever of an American second lady, which is Fluoride, like
the mineral?
F-L-O-R-I-D.
Fluoride?
Fluoride? I don't know. I like fluoride.
I feel like fluoride has an E at the end of it.
It has an E at the end of it.
It does? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Did I spell it wrong? I probably spelled it wrong.
I don't think you finished spelling it. I don't think you finished the E. But yeah, that's fluoride. Yeah. It's a weird name.
Oh, it's Flo-Rida Calhoun.
Flo-Rida.
She starts ostracizing. So that's John C. Calhoun's wife, obviously. She starts ostracizing Peg Eaton.
Can you say her, wait, her name was, I thought you said her name was Florida or Fluoride. Whose name was actually Fluoride?
Calhoun's wife.
Then who's Peggy Eaton?
Peggy Eaton is Secretary of War John Eaton's wife.
Okay. All right. I think I'm back on track now.
Basically, Peggy Eaton and John Eaton, there's a rumor going around about her being an adulterer with John prior to their marriage. And this, so, you know, Fluoride, how do you pronounce that? Somebody comment if I'm pronouncing that wrong, because I like looked this up like four times and there's nothing in a pronunciation dictionary. God, this pronunciation is wild. So it ends up being this big controversy because like the political elite women are not letting Peggy Eaton into these different events. And at this time, that's, I don't want to make it sound like that's childish. I mean, that is literally that was their like kind of their civic responsibility during this time period, was that they were supposed to be part of these festive groups that would host different parties and stuff like that. So for Peggy Eaton to be removed from that was considered like a big slight. Whether or not you think they should have been doing that, it was still a slight. Like I wouldn't make it sound like it was. I don't want to be dismissive of it. So Jackson like heavily sides with Peggy Eaton and John Eaton because he remembers his late wife Rachel going through all this slander and all this horrible stuff.
Yeah,
he starts going after all these prominent women, call them gossipers, and they're fanning the flames. And they should be ashamed of themselves.
Is he doing this as president?
As president, this is 1831, so he's the president.
Right.
He gets so aggressive that it basically paralyzes a lot of the official business in the White House and in the executive branch, and he poisons a lot of the relationships with the administration to the point where by the spring of 1831. Jackson forces a reorganization. So he's about a year and a half into his term, his first term, forces a reorganization. At this point, Secretary Eaton, I don't blame him, is done with this. He's like, I don't want to put my wife through this. Who knows what the true story is? And it's not fair to them either. I mean, like, they're married at this point. Like, this is something that I think why Jackson felt this way, because it's a very similar story to Rachel. Remember, I said, there's this myth that Rachel had, like, him and her and Jackson had an affair and all that. Like, no, she had been divorced for 3 years before they even met. It wasn't fair to say that about Rachel.
No, Jackson. And they rectified the thing immediately afterwards too.
Yeah. Literally they were like, oh crap, this never went through officially. Let's go back to the courthouse. So it's like, again, it says a lot about Jackson. So Eaton resigns, which I makes sense. I'd probably do the same thing in the same situation. I think most people would be like, this isn't worth my wife's health. After seeing what happened with Rachel, you're like, I'm not doing this. This is to the point where Andrew Jackson's puppet, Martin Van Buren, Secretary of State Martin Van Buren, voluntarily resigns so that they can just do a full reset. And one by one, nearly all the cabinet secretaries are replaced by the end of June of 1831, a full reset. Cabinet. And that is where the term kitchen cabinet comes in. Because during this time period, Jackson relied on all these informal advisors to make his way through here. And Martin Van Buren would eventually become vice president during the next election, in the election of 1832. But isn't that amazing? He was willing to burn down his entire cabinet. It did burn down his entire cabinet because how fiercely he wanted to defend Peggy Eaton. Not John Eaton. I want to be clear. This was not him defending his Secretary of War. This was him defending his Secretary of War's wife.
Get behind that one.
Get behind that. There's a lot of personal things Jackson does that you like him, and a lot of policy side stuff where you don't like him.
Yes. I think that's pretty well described.
Yeah. So simultaneously during this, we have something called the nullification theory emerge, and basically, it all begins. John C. Calhoun, who's his vice president, back in 1818, penned a lot of these anonymous letters that were basically advocating to censure Jackson for his unauthorized invasion of Spanish Florida. Jackson finds out those are written by Calhoun. He starts getting it's a personal rift. They end up having these very heated letters. Anybody, go back and read them. They're kind of nuts. The thing of vice president and president are writing these horrible mm-hmm. letters to one another. Jackson blows up. He's a very angry guy in these letters. Eventually, you actually see John C. Calhoun resigns, becomes the senator to South Carolina. During this process, he had anonymously authored, this is 1828, so this is, he's still, you know, vice president under Adams. He right. writes this thing called South Carolina Exposition and Protest, basically outlining the legal case for states to be able to nullify federal law. This, we won't get into too much detail about nullification because it's incredibly interesting legal topic, but that never actually resulted in anything because of, basically, Jackson is given military authority through Congress to go and enforce using force. It's called the Force Bill. I'm going to say the word force a lot because that sounds like a fake word. Right. Congress passes a couple of years after this something called the Force Bill. He's allowed to go down there and collect tariffs using military force because the whole idea of nullification was South Carolina was railing after the passing of the abominable tariffs and these other tariffs in 1832 that John C. Calhoun authors this, you know, we can nullify federal law, which is insane. But just nobody agrees with that. And, you know, Andrew Jackson's willing to fight about it. So he wants to go right. down there and enforce it.
Basically, that's interesting because we talked about how he put the country on the path to the Civil War, but this almost looks like the test runs of trying to secede.
Oh, it is. And his last move in office, which is the recognizing of Texas, is a move towards the Civil War, without a doubt.
Really?
Yeah, because it's a slave state. It's very clearly a slave state that just fought a war to have slaves. Like the Texas War of Independence was right. them seceding from Mexico so they could have slaves. So it's no getting around that.
I don't remember that being taught.
Yeah. My biggest theory, like the Alamo were the bad guys because they were fighting for slavery. So eventually, just real quick to wrap up nullification, eventually Congress passes this law that will ease over the next 10 years the tariffs of 1832 back to normal levels. South Carolina agrees and, you know, relents. But as a one last middle finger to the administration, the last thing the Constitutional Convention of South Carolina did was nullify the force bill. And I find that very funny because I would love to see Andrew Jackson, who once said to John Marshall, Supreme Court Justice John Marshall, Chief Justice John Marshall, when John Marshall said, hey, you can't move the Cherokee off their land, he said, well, you come down here and stop me with your army.
Your army can stop,
I don't think Andrew Jackson would be like, oh, you vetoed you nullified the force bill. Guess everybody has to go home.
I know.
He would take immense pleasure in making sure that bill was carried out.
But just the glee in nullifying that the idea of no, you didn't. I know what you are, but what am I? That's basically that.
You and one army. Right. So as we kind of transition out through 1831, you have, and I do want to do a footnote because I think this is not a footnote, but I do want to do an acknowledgement because in 1831, August of 1831, we have the Nate Turner's Rebellion occurring. I know
it was slave rebellion, wasn't it?
The slave rebellion. Yeah. About 50 white Virginians were killed, and the state militia had to be called in.
Was this the one that actually captured like a federal buildings? Or is that a different one I'm thinking of?
Harper's Ferry.
Which
is John Brown. I've been there. Harper's Ferry. Yeah. Very small. Very small building. But it creates an interesting event because the governor of Virginia, John Floyd, he basically asked Jackson if he could have federal assistance to contain the revolt. By the way, it's called a rebellion. This was a revolt, man. Like they had a lot of success actually getting people to.
It's difference between to a rebellion engage. And a revolt.
I mean, they both ended in failure. Usually, a rebellion's smaller. I mean, colloquially, a rebellion smaller, a revolt usually organized.
Gotcha.
So he calls in. So the U.S. Army actually comes down there, and this was very controversial because he had to use the Militia Act of 1795 to go in there and basically crush the revolt. And a lot of people had this like, is that what the Militia Act's for?
Right.
Like, is that what that feels like? That's not what the Militia Act's like.
Not supposed to raise militia to shoot Americans.
Yeah, the Militia Act was more like, no, that gives you the ability to raise a militia, not the U.S. Army, the standing army, to go do stuff. That's
right.
Obviously, that's illegal in the United States now. We have the Posse, can never pronounce that word. Posse Comitatus Act. I have to slow down to say that.
I don't think we've said it right since we've.
Oh no, we haven't. So we do have, we do have kind of one other international event, which is there's the sport. I saw two pronunciations from this. One is the Spoilation Act. I prefer the Spoilation Act, which is basically during the Napoleonic War, Napoleon sees a bunch of U.S. ships, and they never paid us back. So he actually got France to pay us back $25 million, $5 million at the time. It would be a huge controversy. He tried to go to war with France. He wanted like permission to fight them because it took them about 5 years to pay him. But he did eventually get it. Britain stepped in and was like, this guy invaded Spain and threw over governors when he was a major, when he was a major general.
He's like, a president now, don't
you? Yeah. Listen, there's a part called French Canada, and that's what you call American Canada if you don't pay him his $5 million. $5 million.
There was – oh, I'm sorry. Are you –
No, no, go.
I'll wait till you're finished because there's one other thing I wanted to ask about.
No, that's the end of the French one. Yeah.
I thought I remembered an incident happening with Mr. Jackson where an assassin tried to shoot him, or he pulled out a pistol, fired, misfired, pulled out a second backup pistol. It also misfired. And then Andrew Jackson proceeded to beat the ever living crap out of this guy with his hickory stick.
Kyle, my beloved, you we're skipping ahead. We're skipping ahead. We're
skipping ahead. Oh, okay. I didn't know when this was. I was like, man, you haven't even mentioned this yet. What?
you love the like discussions about the president's doing crazy stuff. I was, you know, I'm not joking. I'm joking.
You've just been saving this one for me.
Yeah. So, January 30th, 1835. This guy, Richard Lawrence, Dick Lawrence. He basically shows up to...
There's so many dicks in history.
There's a lot of dicks in history.
I know.
But yeah, he's an unemployed house painter. And he which I don't know why history has that written down. Yeah, unemployed house painter. So not like unemployed, which is the correct answer.
Yeah.
He was like a house painter who didn't have a job that day. It's like you show up to work.
Does that just mean that he would refuse to do anything else?
Yeah.
Like, well, we got a job at the printing press. He's like, no, I'm a house painter.
I'm a house painter. Can you paint this office? Houses.
No. Do you not understand? The White House, I've heard that needs painted.
Right after that crazy party. So he pops up, goes over to Jackson, draws two pistols. They say pistols. I don't know if they were pistols at the time. They were probably.
I mean, it's got like a matchlock.
Or flintlock or matchlock, whatever.
Some maybe. Type of, yeah.
And so he fires, both miss. And so Andrew Jackson, he's 67 at the time. He takes his cane and beats the ever-living urine out of this dude.
At 67? I didn't realize he was 67 at the time.
Yeah. Oh, he's like, man, yeah. Which is like ancient from back then.
Yeah.
and he ends up like beating the absolute crap out of the guy. The guy gets arrested. Now, as the guy's getting arrested, there's all this like national backlash and stuff that like Lawrence was driven by, you know, political motives and all this stuff. You know, Jackson actually starts telling people the Whigs did it. He's kind of, I don't know. I'd be like, that's, I would say funny, but it's kind of like,
God, the public think this is amazing, doesn't it?
Yeah. The public think this is amazing. They think it's divine providence that he survives this. Then the guy's just found to be completely insane and incapable of standing trial. Which, do you realize how insane you have to be in 1835 to not be able to stand trial? Like, you're like, actually, like, that's not like, we need to review this guy. It's like, dude, I can't even get him to sit behind the desk to talk to him. So yeah, this is a crazy guy.
What book did he read? Because this is well before Catcher in the Rye.
Dude, I was going to say Catcher in the Rye.
Like, the only book I know of from this time period is Reminiscences of James Madison, Man's Reminiscences of James Madison.
By Paul Jennings?
Yeah, that's the only book I'm familiar with.
Yeah, he just read that. He's like, do I need to go assassinate Jack?
This is nothing like Jack.
He's just violently reading poor Richard Almanacs. Wait a minute. Where's Jackson today? Dick Lawrence. I was going to get to that.
I thought you were wrapping up. I'm sorry. I keep cutting.
I have a speed run I want to do, if that's cool with you.
Yeah, go for it.
All right. So a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about in the fourth episode. So that's the only reason that we're kind of speeding through it, but just to give you chronological order. Immediately after we have the Peggy Eaton affair and all that stuff, we go into him videoing the second bank rechartering, right? And that's in July 10th, 1832. Causes this huge distortion and destabilization of the central bank market.
I thought it was already established. How do you veto something that's already been passed?
There's 20-year charters.
Oh, so gotcha.
If you remember,
okay. Gotcha.
James Madison signed the second one.
Yeah.
He ends up withdrawing all this money and putting them into what he called pet banks, which are small state banks. So there's no centralized liquidity management of any of this. And again, we're going to cover this in next week's episode when we start talking about, you know, the Panic of 1837. We're gonna run up to it. I don't want to harp too much on. I think it's important to talk about his battle with Nicholas Biddle, but we're going to get into a little more. It's going to be an economist being able to talk about a crisis, so I don't want to curtail myself. But, you know, if this is the only episode you're listening to and on it, it's a fight with Nicholas Biddle. It's called the Bank Wars. Jackson's veto wasn't able to be overridden by Congress, which means it kind of turned into... Yeah, he basically
killed the National Bank.
Kills the National Bank. This would have horrible repercussions. It would destroy monetary policy, and it was all...
I wonder if maybe this led to a recession.
I'm so angry about that. We're going to have to... That episode's going to be bad. No, contemporary to this, we have the Black Hawk Wars going on. These are the first, what a lot of historians would say, the first Native American frontier wars, and that's in 1832. Hmm. They're very bloody. They're very bloody for a war of that time period. You're talking about... you had a leader called Black Hawk. By the way, the leader was called Black Hawk for some reason. People like say Black Hawk Tribe. I see that. I've seen it like five times, and I'm like, no, Black Hawk was a person.
That's the Chicago Blackhawks is named that. That's the picture of him on their logo.
Yeah,
right?
Sauk is the tribe is the Sauk tribe of that area. This is all throughout Illinois. It causes all this settler panic, and basically what happens is Andrew Jackson's like, whoa, we can't have settlers coming back, deploys the army, ends up being these, it's the U.S. Army basically goes in there and wipes out the militia and ends up wiping out a bunch of civilians too, including women and children. It was horrible. It's definitely the whole Native American frontier war is a black eye for many reasons. It's also something clouded in nuance and stuff like that I feel sometimes needs to get discussed more thoroughly.
Also was a victim of a lot of revisionist history.
A lot. And I think a lot in bad and good ways sometimes. Yeah. Not bad and good ways, but in like both sides write revisionist history.
Yes.
Something interesting though, a lot of historians agree that Jackson didn't like order these massacres. He basically sent the U.S. military out there to be like, hey, make sure people can not get attacked in their homes. Because that was happening. Basically, you had 1,000 of these troops, the Sauk and the Fox people.
Were they officers that he put in position who also watched him butcher the Seminoles when he was down there last time?
No, these officers went way too. Okay. They would have all been retired by then.
All right.
Yeah. That was something I looked into.
He set a bit of a standard that maybe they were trying to live up to. They were probably trying to go get more land for the president and run up to Canada.
Yeah. So they basically were told, go out there, protect the frontiers, and they started these cross-Mississippi attacks because the settlers were getting attacked by these 1,000 troops.
Yeah.
The 1,000 Sauk and Fox were going across Mississippi, and they were attempting to reclaim through force their ancestral lands. The U.S. Army's like, well, you're just attacking civilians, so we're going to go after you. And then tit for tat never really ends up with anybody being okay. And this culminates in Jackson's reelection in November of 1832. He got 219 electoral college votes.
Jeez.
You know, yeah, dude. Henry Clay came in second place with 49. We did see our first Whig candidate.
Clay.
Kind of pop up.
Always the vice president, never the president.
At this time, as we mentioned earlier, we have the Nullification Acts that we discussed. That kind of dominates most of the early part of his second term. I told the nullification story all as one because I feel like if I just kept going back to nullification, I think people think more would have happened when in reality, it was one thing happened. It was like one thing. the force bill got passed, and Jackson was like, I'm not going to enforce this. Now something cool. This is really cool. We see the first Asian American trade.
Really?
Yeah, it's not notable. It's not a lot. It's nothing that's like redefining. But Thailand, Siam at the time, in Muscat, or what's now Oman, both signed trade deals with the United States in 1830. It was like around 1833 they started, but it concluded in 1836. And now American merchants were selling in what would be the Middle East and in Southeast Asia.
When did we start establishing ports on the West Coast?
There's definitely some ports at this time. This is 1833. So you are starting to see some movement in California. We're not the Gold Rush area yet. But no, it was, so we're traveling
just,
a long
I'm just
distance.
Thinking, like, man, that's going to be huge for whatever port towns are already out there.
And again, it's not like there's not that much to it. Like, it's interesting. If that's something that interests you, it's right. Interesting. I'm not, I hope I never sound dismissive if I say, like, oh, well, this story is a little more interesting than the other one. But no, is that. I thought that was interesting. Yeah. Like, oh, that's the first time we had international trade with Asia. And who would have guessed? That's a good pub trivia question.
Who would have thought Jackson would be the one to open up trade with Asia? Yeah.
Yeah.
right. To initiate.
Ironic that, you know, the start of the executive expansion occurred under Jackson starting trade with Asia, and it ended under Nixon, who started trade with China. That's kind of a weird one. You know, by this point, we see, Kyle, you made a joke earlier about it, so but we start seeing the removing of federal deposits from the central bank. And basically Jackson was like, calls up his Secretary of Treasury, and he's like, hey, can you remove these deposits? And that guy's name was Lewis McLean. He was like, no, I'm not removing deposits from a federal bank, putting them in state banks just because you like them. So he was like, well, you're going to go to the State Department. Doesn't fire him outright, puts him in the State Department. And then Jackson appoints this guy, William Duane. And he's like, yo, Bill, can you do this? And Bill's like, yeah, sure. And then Bill starts doing it. And he's like, actually, I think this is illegal or actually, he goes, I think it's illegal and kind of dumb. And he goes, dude, he literally wrote, unwise is how he described it, which is dumb for that time period. Yeah. So then he fires him and installs, he actually should have fired him. He just missed him, which I think is kind of funny. I don't agree with that. I think Dwayne was right, but.
Yeah.
So you
again,
end up
consistent.
So then he actually appoints his attorney general, Roger Daney, as the acting treasurer. And he eventually he does it. And this really ends the bank war, but deals the fatal blow.
How many pardons did Jackson have to give out when he left office?
I don't have those numbers. The idea of presidential pardons certainly existed back then, but that's actually a great question. I will do research.
I just wonder
on
if
that.
if he had to let a bunch of people off the hook before he got out of there.
And as we start hitting the close of Andrew Jackson's presidency, we actually come to a moment that would enrage Jackson the rest of his life. So after all he's doing, where it comes to removing funds from the bank and pushing some, I don't want to say Black Hawk War wasn't, I don't want to say popular, but wasn't considered overly, an overreach of executive power. But a bunch of these things started to correlate. And we start seeing what the Senate moved and become anti-Jackson. And by late 1830s, mid 1830s, let's say, it's very anti-Jackson. It's an anti-Jackson majority. And Henry Clay, who at this time is the senator from South Carolina, specifically targets the removal of federal deposits as an unconstitutional abuse of power, and the Senate votes to censure Jackson.
Wow.
Which is a big move. And they start calling him King Andrew, that is where you start seeing the Whigs form as being the anti-royalist. You know, Jackson's enraged, but moves on. And at this point, towards the end of his presidency, he starts establishing the Indian territories, which are mostly in, lands west of the Mississippi, not in Missouri or Louisiana or Arkansas territory. We start to see Oklahoma, this idea start to develop. You see the Office of Indian Affairs. Exists, which is still around today. The Bureau of Indian Affairs is still around today. But it's within the it's within the War Department, which is probably not the best place.
Weird place to put it, but all right.
You have a Secretary of State. That's probably where that should go. And, by this time, we do see a series of acts get passed that will establish the Indian Territory. And it does become a destination for the, quote, five civilized tribes. Some other one-off tribes that have been uprooted. Surprise, doesn't solve the problem at all. Just doesn't solve the problem one bit.
Yeah.
As Jackson closes
shocking.
Up, yeah, right. As Jackson kind of comes into the apex of his second term, we see the nation become debt-free in 1835.
So he actually did it.
He did it. And in 1836, which is obviously the last year of his presidency, the nation has plenty of fundings, plenty of money, and they're trying to figure out how to establish and give it back to the states. Like I mentioned earlier, they never really figure it out. they never really figured it out.
Well, and luckily, there was a recession to lose all that money. So
luckily, we went immediately back into debt.
Yeah, exactly. all right. Well, I mean, that was quite the ride, I think. So what's next? What are we doing next week?
So next week we're going to talk about the two major parts of legacy of Jackson, right? What things that exist today because of Andrew Jackson. One of them is going to be him causing the Panic of 1837, which would eventually, over the next 80 years, culminate with the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. And the last one is the outstanding question of indigenous people and how that would play itself out over probably another 80 years. We're going to start off with the Second Seminole War that I mentioned earlier, which kind of came to the end of Jackson's presidency. But as we leave Jackson, you know, Kyle, mm-hmm. you said to me something interesting and something that I struggled with here, too. You said, you know, it doesn't sound like he's trying to start a civil war, right? And I don't think it sounds like it. He's talking about federal authority. He's marching troops into South Carolina. South Carolina, the state that would start the civil war.
Yeah.
But as we leave Jackson, right, as we leave Jackson part, and we will, you know, we leave him with his last thing he ever did, essentially the last thing he ever did was recognizing Texas. He did that just as he was leaving. That was controversial because, as we mentioned earlier, Texas was going to be a slave state. They essentially fought a war to establish slavery. Jackson couldn't stop being Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
And in a footnote that's really taught and not mentioned that much, is something called the abolitionist mailings. And in 1835, abolitionists started spam mailing every house in the South, started mailing them pro-abolitionist material. And pro-emancipation material, anti-slavery pamphlets.
Sounds like Ben Banneker striking again.
Kind of. Oh, God. Best top five American.
Right.
The Southerners are just angered beyond belief on this. And the slaveholding Southerners are angered beyond belief on this. And they demand action. And this is where Jackson can't help himself but push the nation closer to the Civil War. He steps in. Congress would not pass a law barring who could mail what. Instead, he de facto allows Southern postmasters to simply not deliver what he called inflammatory mailings and reference the gag rule.
What? That is wild.
Yep. And this is when the Northerners, a lot of Northerners.
Oh, this when they probably got more... What's the word? They went from probably being more passive to being a lot more aggressive with their...
There's a lot of neutral Northerners who suddenly went, whoa, that is a violation of my civil liberties if I've ever seen one.
Right.
And it did this beautiful thing where it connected the complete trouncing of freedoms and rights that afflicted enslaved individuals at this time and married them to the suppression of civil rights of white Northerners. That would remain married together until the end of the Civil War. This idea that, our rights are not being taken away. And I do think that's the beauty of this discussion, that if the rights get taken away of one, what stops your rights from getting taken away?
Yes.
And Jackson would inadvertently marry those two things together in the North. People who had no opinion on slavery suddenly went, you tell me what I can mail? Whoa, that's government overreach and a half.
And yeah. Can you love a guy for doing the wrong thing so well that he got the right thing to happen?
Yeah, right. And, you know, it, again, I know Jackson's presidency could be you get a bachelor's degree in it, and certainly I don't want you, people to think that, you know, the conversation Kyle and I had is his whole entire presidency. I could have went on for 15 hours.
Oh God, I know.
But what it really comes down to is that everything we talked about here has a whole nother story behind it, and it's great to dive in deeper. But as we leave Jackson's presidency, we are now, the brakes are off. There's nothing stopping us. We are headed to civil war. Mm-hmm. That's where this is going. And we got a little over half a dozen presidents that are going to, some of them are going to try and stop it. Most of them are going to try and start it. We're headed to a civil war right now. It's just where we're going. And nothing is better than showing how something as simple as stopping pamphlets
is what actually fanned the flames or started the seed. Yeah, so, I love that.
So thank you, Kyle. Thank you for letting me try and get through Jackson without dying.
I love that it all comes back to like the power of the press again, really.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's just, don't mess with my mail, man. All right, well, join us next week then when we do all the stuff that Eric just said, because I don't even remember all of it. Hopefully he wrote notes. While you're waiting for the part four to come out, reach out, tell us. Let's see, what are you going to tell us? Tell us who you think you would have voted for in the 1828 election. Because honestly, I'm thinking like everything I've seen up to that point, I would have probably voted for Jackson. You can do that in the comments.
Yeah, that's a completely normal way. I would have voted for John Quincy Adams again because I'm a complete homer. And I'm like, my boy is running. Nothing to do with politics.
Right. You can do that in the comments or by emailing us at buckstartsherepodcast@gmail.com. On your way out, visit the website at buckstartshere.com to browse our growing back catalog. Hit subscribe on your favorite platform, and we'll see you all next week if I ever get past this freaking outro. All right, stop. Produced by China Shop Productions.